Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 6 years ago, the city council in the Dayton suburb of Beaver Creek opposed a plan to expand the number of bus stops at the local mall. 2 years later, after the federal government found the rejection a violation of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Beaver Creek City Council members had a change of heart. The story of the Beaver Creek bus stops is the focus of a 2017 documentary produced by the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State. It's now available for free online. You can check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides to see Free to Ride. We're talking about public transportation and low-income people in the United States today. Joining us is writer and producer of Free to Ride, Matt Martin. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
So give us a thumbnail of the story. What happened? What was the problem?
Yeah, well, there was a bus route that importantly cut across the entire city and region of Dayton from the far west side all the way out to the eastern suburbs. And folks started paying attention to the fact that it ended just short of where a lot of the newer development in the region had taken place over the past decade.
So, and where a lot of the jobs were.
Right. So there's a lot of jobs. There's a new hospital, a regional mall, a STEM school. So there are a lot of different things, not just jobs, but really a variety of opportunities. And there was a coalition similar to what we have here in Columbus called BREAD. In Dayton, it's called LEAD, that found this and made it their issue. They heard the testimony of folks who had been walking over this interstate overpass to get to jobs on the other side of the highway, been taking the bus out as far as it goes, then having to walk a mile and a half to get to jobs and various other things. So they made this their issue. They took it to the RTA there in Dayton, and RTA was really open to trying to resolve it.
Thought it was a great idea.
This had been on their radar for years anyways. They knew the development was increasing traffic out there. So they came up with a proposal, submitted it to the Beaver Creek Public Works Department. And that's where the process started to slow down a little bit. But they were, you know, they were set on doing this. They worked with the department, came up with a proposal that met all the city's ordinances, guidelines, et cetera. And when it goes to City Council for final approval, there's a series of conversations that get tabled at City Council meetings for the following 2 months, and then it eventually gets unanimously turned down. And the talk and the rhetoric and the questions around it are really opaque. But when it comes down to it, it's pretty clear among residents in all parts of the community, among riders, in the press, that it had a lot to do with race, poverty, and the history of the community's racism. West Dayton, in large part because of policies like redlining, was where most of the African Americans in Dayton live. The east suburbs were not that way. The development along the interstate beltway had brought a lot of jobs and opportunity to that side of the city. Mm-hmm. So folks were understandably just trying to go to where jobs and opportunity existed.
The lawyer, Ellis Jacobs, who argued the civil rights suit against the city of Beaver Creek, summarized the point of law in the film. Let's hear.
Beaver Creek is 3% African American. The city of Dayton, where the bus that they wanted to run there comes from, is more than 40% African. So the statistics make it very clear that if you bar buses from your community, you're going to have a disparate impact on minorities.
Hmm. Aside from not wanting the bus stops, what did the Beaver Creek City Council give as explanations for why they opposed this? They didn't say it's because of we don't want poor people and blacks.
No. And that would have been actually grounds for an actual
automatic suit, right,
instead of a civil rights complaint based on disparate impact. What they were pegging it to was really a community survey that had been done shortly before all of this came to a head. There was a general question raised in the community about public transit, and there was really mixed opinions about it. And they started getting some calls and emails from some of their citizens, which is one of the scenes in the movie where they start tallying up, well, we've received, you know, 150 emails from people in the community, and most of them are saying they don't want this. And that's where they kind of left it, which was sort of a safe but still fairly opaque way to leave an issue like this. So they were hearing from vocal constituents, and that's what primarily was driving their opinion.
How did this trigger this? It was a civil rights complaint. Thanks for the correction. It's a complaint. What happened?
So they filed this complaint with the Federal Highway Administration because they found in their research, the attorneys found in their research, that the city of Beaver Creek gets a lot of federal funding for their highways and their roads and their bridges. And they said, well, if you receive federal aid, you know, the 1964 Civil Rights Act dictates that you can't discriminate on the basis of race or anything. So they filed this complaint really on a lark, on a hope, in the chance that the agency would investigate it and take it seriously. They filed it based on disparate impact. And part of what they were showing was, you know, despite intent, regardless of intent, this disproportionately by far negatively impacts African-Americans in the community. And that was their case, really.
Mm-hmm. And they prevailed.
It took a couple years. The federal agency sent out an investigator. There was a lot of, I'm sure, internal politics happening in the agency in D.C., but they finally decided, with support from their legal counsel, that they had to move forward with a complaint. And the precedent-setting, you know, part of the story is that it was the first time in its history that the Federal Highway Administration had ever issued a violation of Civil Rights Act.
And has this played out? I mean, is this something that's playing out in other communities as well because of this lawsuit or this complaint?
Yeah. So one of the folks from Federal Highway who we interviewed for the film goes on later in the film to really talk about how they started getting calls from public agencies all over the country, really wanting to just make sure that they're in compliance. So you've seen a lot more of that. You've seen things like, I think it's in Alabama, there was a BMV that was closed. It's a transportation thing because of that, but it also became a voting rights thing because folks need driver's license or photo IDs in order to vote in a lot of cases. So,
and if you don't have a driver's license because you can't own a car,
yeah,
it disproportionately impacts African Americans in that case.
Yeah. So this story really did start to shine a light on some other civil rights issues related to transportation. And what we found, too, is, you know, when folks, regardless of what city or state they're in, when they see this film or when they've heard this story, they immediately have a reaction of, well, it's like this in our community. And it may be transportation related. It may be, you know, in D.C., the folks, the film premiered in D.C. at the D.C. Independent Film Festival. And a lot of folks there were taking note of the fact that there are a lot of similarities with their purple rail line there.
Oh, so?
And some of the history of where rail lines were built in D.C. and where they were not built, mm-hmm. and how services are being cut to some of those routes now. There's a lot of the same issues at play. But there are even folks in different communities who can see connections between a story like this and housing, NIMBY issues with housing, or issues of school segregation. So even though, you know, the particulars in communities vary, a lot of the same dynamics are at play.
In the final analysis, Beaver Creek City Council voted to approve the three new stops at the mall. But two people still opposed it. They stuck to their guns, right?
They did, yeah. There were a couple folks that voted against it twice. And, you know, you can see, again, the pressure to make sure that you're representing your constituents. And in Beaver Creek, you know, that is a subset of the population that votes.
What was their concern about crime? How did they justify that concern? How does a bus stop create crime opportunity?
Well, there's a bit of history there in Dayton, and it's probably true of a lot of communities where some of the places in the 1980s and 90s where there were crime, there also happened to be bus service. So there's a mall out on the Upper West Side of Dayton. There's some shopping areas downtown where there were crime issues. Some of it was related to youth in the community, but the way in this story it was pinned to public transit was pretty nefarious. That association that of all the things that might be causing crime, and they are many, disinvestment in communities for long periods of time being one of them, to say that, well, bus routes are what caused crime was kind of ridiculous, but it was playing on fears and playing on some of the stereotypes of that community's history.
They were willing, a couple of the members of the board of the city council were willing to vote against it, even with this $10 million sword of Damocles hanging over their neck, that they were going to be cut by that much. There was a lot of issues about, well, we're going to have to raise taxes. Beaver Creek's not known for wanting to raise its taxes. It's a high income area, but still.
Yeah, and it's actually one of the very few municipalities in the state of Ohio that doesn't have an income tax.
Huh.
So that was going to be a big hit for them, of course. But yeah, you know, whether it's on principle or whether it's, you know, just realizing like I want to take my stand, but I know that the rest of my city council, you know, fellow members are going to make sure we don't have to face that calamity or whatever. There's a lot of reasons why elected officials do vote for and don't for things.
So how did it go? They've got the three bus stops there. Have you ever checked back on it? And
yeah, that's the sort of remarkable thing about the aftermath is that the Dayton Daily News did a study sometime after, and they said, if anything, all we can conclude is that crime went down by 6% in this area. So really, it's had little to no effect on safety, has possibly even promoted public safety in some ways.
By getting people off the overpass.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, there's probably a lot of things going on, but I also know that RTA and several community members took very seriously the responsibility of making sure that it went well. And so they were out. Mark Donaghy famously talks about how he goes out there every now and then just to pick up trash. This is the CEO of the RTA.
And Dayton. Yeah. Well, Mark Martin, thank you. I'm sorry, Matt Martin, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Matt Martin is writer and producer of the documentary film Free to Ride. It looks at the story of the travails of building three bus stops, expanding the RTA in Dayton area to a mall in Beaver Creek suburb, and what they went through to get that to accomplish that goal. We're going to talk about the relationship between public transit and opportunities for low-income and minority neighborhoods and minority communities in Ohio and across the country. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Public transportation is all about economic and social mobility. Minority and low-income communities are most dependent on public transportation, according to the Pew Research Center. We're talking about that relationship today. Joining us by phone is Vice President of Government Affairs at the Center for Neighborhood Technology. That's an Illinois-based nonprofit working to create sustainable urban communities. She works in transportation. Jackie Grimshaw, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann. Thank you for having me.
And also by phone, assistant professor at the City University of New York, Kafui Ato. His research focuses on urban public transit and transportation equity. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Kafui, you argue that public transportation is a civil right. How so?
Well, the way I describe it in the book is, you know, I talk a lot about rights, but the way I start is, One way to think about transit is that transit is more like a promise. It's a promise that says, you know, if you are too poor to own a car or to maintain a car, if you are too old to drive a car, if you have a disability, that you should still be able to get around and still be able to participate in public life, let alone get to your job, get to church, and all those sorts of things. So it's a promise. And I think many people get it at a visceral level, but it doesn't play out in our cities.
You also talk about the right to be part of a city. It's interesting. Construction, you know, as far as the city should be built, and that people have a right to have cities built for them to be accessible.
Yep. I think that is, so there's a lot of challenges, of course, to doing that. But there's a history of struggle associated with transportation that is precisely on those terms. Having access to public transit is oftentimes having access to the political process, voice, access to other people, and the built environment matters in that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the promise of public transportation and its relationship to upward mobility for minority communities, for impoverished communities. You just heard from Kafui Ato. He's an assistant professor at the City University of New York. Also with us, Jackie Grimshaw, Vice President of Government Affairs at the Center for Neighborhood Technology. Jackie, you've worked in transportation for decades. We were talking earlier in the program about this issue in Dayton where the bus stopped 1 mile short of where so many of the Dayton residents were working in this Beaver Creek suburb. Is that part of a common theme across the country?
Well, it is a common theme in areas that are usually Caucasian, suburban, upper middle class kind of communities. In transportation history, there's always been this connect between access to the labor force and participation. If you can't transport yourself to where there is a job, then you are left out. You're isolated economically, socially, etc. And so the history in this country has been that when there has been the push for people of color or impoverished people to get transit, those in power or Caucasian or upper middle class, have pushed back. And so we've seen that in urban places like Atlanta, as well as places like Beaver Creek, as well as places like suburban Buffalo, now in New York. So it's not Beaver Creek, is unusual, but then not really that unusual, if you understand the nuance that I'm trying to make.
Right. How, when it comes to transportation, Jackie Grimshaw, I mean, what is the calculus in figuring out, do you go one more mile or where do you stop a line? How does that work?
Well, usually in transportation planning, there's a analysis that's called origin and destination. Where are people located that need access to transportation, and where are the places that they're going or need to go? And so you plan your transportation routes based upon that origin and destination calculus. In Beaver Creek, for example, the folks, who lived in the communities in Dayton that wanted to get access to jobs, where the origin is their location in Dayton, their destination is the mall in Beaver Creek. And so the an equitable planning process would have figured out how to provide access on transit from where those people are in Dayton to that shopping mall in Beaver Creek. And the fact that they didn't do that was deliberate and kind of a violation of the folks' civil rights who are trying to get access to the labor market.
It sounds like, Kafui Ato, that this is a conversation that should have happened maybe even at the zoning process and at the zoning stage of all of this, if you're going to build this mall, or at the funding, if there were public funds involved in building the mall, but you have to provide, there has to be these accommodations made. Is that done enough?
I'm not quite sure about this particular case, but, you know, there should be an open kind of process, open to the public, so that as transportation planners are designing routes, they are meeting with stakeholders and shareholders to make sure that people's needs are met, and especially the needs of riders who are, you know, who they're trying to serve. I think in many places, you know, the public participation process could be improved. It's either truncated, the communications aren't adequate enough. People can't show up sometimes because they
exactly.
because of transit itself. they can't make the meeting,
right. Which
is, you know, highly ironic. But then there's also the question, the point that my colleague across on the other side, on the other phone made, which is that there's also, you know, the loudest voices are often the people with, you know, money or who are afraid of what transit brings, oftentimes totally unjustifiably. So, the public participation process is central and too often excludes marginalized people and transit riders who constitute that group.
Jackie?
And, you know, what he's saying is not just nice to have. You know, yesterday our attention was on the funeral for the 41st president, George Herbert Walker Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that he signed into law while he was in office in 1991 was a federal act that was called, you know, the act, everything in transportation is about acronym, and it's called ICE-T, but the real name was Intermodal Surface Transportation Efficiency
That's right.
Act. And what that law required was public participation in the transportation planning process. So what the professor is saying is not something that it'd be nice to do, it's something that you're required by law to do. And President Bush's successor, William Jefferson Clinton, signed an executive order on environmental justice that said that in all areas where federal funds are included, that you have to look at the impact on low-income and minority communities. So, again, a violation of the law was taking place in Beaver Creek.
Mm-hmm.
But the way you get redress is that you have to have, kind of an informed public that says that you're violating my civil rights and that I am going to call attention to it by filing a complaint with the Federal Transportation Administration or U.S. Department of Transportation. But oftentimes, low-income and minority populations are not aware. And so, you know, groups like mine and academic institutions kind of provide that support to people in communities that are being discriminated against to say, hey, we will help you, you know, make this complaint. We will help you raise the attention so that, you know, things like, the battle in Beaver Creek didn't have to happen, or deaths that have occurred in places like Buffalo, you know, won't happen if, in fact, the public is informed and you have people that are supporting, you know, the people who have been discriminated against.
What is the expectation as far as those laws from the Bush, the 41st, and the Clinton administrations? So you have to include them. Is that just you have to let them be involved if they're available to be involved? Or is there the onus of reaching out and going to where they are? Jackie Grimshaw?
The onus is definitely on the Transportation Planning Agency to do outreach to the public. So if they're not doing that, again, you know, they can be held, and the sanction on if it goes to the federal authorities, the sanction is that all of their transportation funds can be held up. And that has happened in places. We have right here in the Midwest where I am, up in Wisconsin, there was a plan to widen up the expressway, again, without providing any funds for transit or allowing those people in Milwaukee to get access to the labor market in the suburbs outside of Milwaukee. And there, you know, they did file a lawsuit, and the state had to come back and provide over $13 million to provide bus routes for people in Milwaukee to get to jobs. And so, you know, one of the things that occurs, you know, not only with transit but also with highways, when these fights happen and these jurisdictions are found to be at fault, is that it usually ends up costing more money. You know, so $13 million that they had to spend in Milwaukee would not have been necessary if they had included people in the planning process in the very beginning. And that's happened around the country. We see those kinds of remedies so that when people violate the law and violate regulations, there is a consequence, and the consequence is usually in millions of dollars.
Kafui Ato, is this, you know, in Columbus, there are some people that travel hours one way to get to their job. They're on the road for hours a day just to get to a job. And I'm wondering, is that just because, you know, of the infrastructure of a place like Columbus, or is that a problem elsewhere?
I think it's a problem in many, many, many cities in the U.S. You know, on one hand, I think there's the question of, you know, the amount of federal and state investment in public transit to improve headways, to make it more frequent. But then there's also the question of sprawl itself. I'm not too familiar with Columbus, but
about how the communities are designed in the first place.
Yeah, I think, you know, there are challenges that transit faces that are associated with just kind of the built environment and the degree to which things are just far apart. But I don't think that's an excuse not to invest in transit transit infrastructure that can. I think those things can be overcome. They have to be overcome with time. I mean, most of our cities have been built around the private automobile, but you know, there we have models and across the world in which cities have made transit something that is can be attractive to people, can draw people, and that can serve people's interests, so that you're not spending 2 hours on a bus in addition to going to work. I mean, think about how much longer your working day is because of that. And the social and economic costs of that to our society, let alone environmental costs, which we haven't talked about, but it's unsustainable environmentally and socially. I would hasten to say criminal, but it's very sad.
Kafui, talk about the stigma around public transportation. When did it come to be? It hasn't always been that way, has it?
No, I wouldn't say it has. You know, I think the highest rates of transit ridership were in the late 1940s. There's also regional differences. I mean, I live in, you know, New York City, which, you know, has the highest transit ridership in the country. Once you take New York City out of the equation in terms of transit ridership for the country, it just, you know, every other place is just really, really different. So I think that there's less stigma here because there's more people who ride it. But the stigma is both a class-based stigma. That is, if you are, you know, wealthy enough to afford a car and you don't need to use the bus, then riding the bus becomes basically a signal that you are poor, and to be poor in this society is to be excluded. And so I think I would say that the stigma, and I'm just guessing here, the stigma probably begins in the 1950s when car ownership explodes, mm-hmm. and public transit becomes a reservoir for those people who can't access private automobiles. But that's just a guess.
But Professor, you can't divorce part of that stigma from race as well. Supposedly the city of the South where African Americans have all of these millionaires and so forth. You look at the history of transit in Atlanta, and it's pretty disgusting. When you look at the separation from people who needed jobs from their ability to get there, and it was all racially motivated, and we still see the remnants of that. And not only in Atlanta, but in urban areas around the country. You're right, New York is an exception mm-hmm. to the rule. But right here in Chicago, where I am, we have a very, very segregated city. And although we have an extensive transit system, what happened here is that the jobs, in order to continue to have that racial discrimination, the jobs moved out of the city to the suburbs where there is no transit access. Now, the Chicago Transit Authority serves the city in 38 suburbs. But these decision makers with the corporations move beyond where the CTA's reach is, and even beyond where Metra, our commuter rail system, reaches. So we have 5 major employment centers in the Chicago area, only one of which is served by transit, and that's downtown Chicago. The other 4 job centers don't have any public transportation.
Well, but those job centers, I dare say, have a lot of public support, right? I mean, there are probably all kinds of TIFs and, tax breaks and that sort of thing given to them, right?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
The state of Illinois is no different than the state of New York in
right.
giving, billions of dollars to billionaires, so that's part
right, but they
of
don't,
the inequity
but there's
in
no,
our country.
But there's always a lot of strings attached when it comes to how many jobs you create and that sort of thing. But I don't, after covering this stuff for 3 decades, I don't recall ever hearing of one with a string attached to making sure that there's access to public transportation for workers.
You're right.
Yeah,
I don't know of any either.
Great point.
No, I mean, seriously, it's an interesting thing that I've never heard before. And when you talk about what universe is it good for a corporate entity to move somewhere that workers can't reach?
You know, this may be totally my speculation, but Sears Roebuck and Company was in downtown Chicago. Mm-hmm. They built a huge tower. They had over 5,500 people working in that tower. They decided to leave the city and go to Hoffman Estates, a place that had no public transportation. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of their employees quit. They wouldn't go out there. Sears had to create their own transit system to move people from the closest train station to their corporate campus. And so those decisions that I think led to part of the demise of Sears, that they were making the wrong decisions and probably for the wrong reason. I can't get into the heads of the decision makers, mm-hmm. but the result is that from a place that a thriving corporation downtown Chicago where they had access to the whole labor market because people are able to get to downtown Chicago, whether by transit or by automobile, mm-hmm. and they moved to a place that was inaccessible. And so those kinds of decisions, now we have Sears in bankruptcy. Mm. And it may be my total speculation, and somebody from Sears is probably going to call and tell me I'm all wet. But, I just look at the impact of what happened, from a tower where you had 5,500 people that got here on transit that had an mm-hmm. affordable way of getting around to a place that was totally inaccessible. Mm.
Jackie Grimshaw, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Oh, no, my pleasure. Thank you.
Jackie Grimshaw, Vice President of Government Affairs at the Center for Neighborhood Technology, and also Kafui Ato, Assistant Professor at City University of New York and author of the forthcoming book, Rights in Transit, Public Transportation and the Right to the City, and the Right to the City in California's East Bay. Thanks so much for joining us, Kafui Ato.
Hey, thank you.
We're going to continue our conversation coming up with the head of special projects for COTA. So stay with us. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment about the local scene when it comes to transportation and accessibility to minorities and low-income communities. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Central Ohio Transit Authority a year ago expanded its reach to, among other locations, traditionally underserved communities and saw a roughly 4% increase in ridership this summer. We're talking about low-income and minority communities and public transportation. Joining us is Director of Government Affairs and Special Projects for COTA, Patrick Harris. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Pleasure to be here.
You know, we were talking about earlier in the program about public transportation as a civil right, that people need it and to be able to have the access and the upward and the mobility in general. How does that fit into the equations you work with at COTA?
Well, I mean, diversity and inclusion is paramount to everything we do at COTA. If you look at some of the investments that we've made most recently, I mean, we talked about in your opening there, the transit system redesign, which began May of last year. That's giving more access to our system, particularly the high frequency lines. So 100,000 more residents in the Central Ohio region now have greater access to high frequency lines, and that's connecting them to 103,000 more jobs in the area. So we talk about mobility being the great equalizer, mm-hmm. and I think we're motivated to connect people to the job centers, to get them from their homes to the jobs, because mobility and access is such an important equation, as you pointed out, to the success, whether you're low income, whoever you are, across the community.
We were talking earlier about this documentary about the case of the Beaver Creek Mall and the need for bus stops there to get most of the workers who worked at the mall back to their homes in the west side of Dayton. There's a really comparable thing here with the Easton development. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, and I really don't know, so I'm generally asking, is there ever any strings attached to transportation for workers when developments go up, with the help of the largesse of the government often?
Yeah, you know what? That's a great point. And what we're trying to do is get in front of those developments.
That's
that you're
what I mean.
About.
Does anyone traditionally, they haven't gotten in front of them.
It hasn't happened.
It's always after the fact.
You're exactly right. Okay. And it can be frustrating when our position at COTA is to help people get to those job centers, right? So we want to have a seat at the table early in those development projects. We look in the dispatch yesterday and talking about what's happening at the Moffray Stadium. Once the crew exits,
right,
they're talking about building a huge community park. Great. And they want to serve Linden. They want to serve Northern Lights. They want to serve Wineland Park. Well, the great equalizer there, again, is getting people to the park. And that's where COTA needs to have a seat at that table early on in the process to say we can be a solutions provider to get people from those neighborhoods to this great new community resource. So you talk about Easton. Excuse me. We have a transit center there,
right,
to help get people to those jobs at Easton. And you look at what's happening right now along the Cleveland Avenue corridor. We have the new C-MAX BRT line, which
this
has been
part of the smart cities thing.
This is the transit. It is partially with the connected infrastructure that's included along the way. You're exactly right. BRT, Bus Rapid Transit, this is COTA's first entry into that, and it's along one of our more heavily traveled routes. What we did is implement a system that gets people from the northern of that route to downtown much quicker, sometimes as much as 10, 15, 20% on a perfect day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It would be nice to have a dedicated lane, but the city did not give us that. But what we've done there is connect low-income communities, Linden, Northern Lights, to two universities in Otterbein and CCAD, to two hospitals at the new Ohio Health Westerville campus, as well as St. Anne's Hospital, all along this bus rapid transit line. So you can see when investment in public transit works for the community, because along that line, we're seeing 20-25% increase in ridership.
Right. And what do you see along that line in terms of buildup, too? I mean, when you once you have relatively dedicated, we know fixed lanes are the gold standard for development around it. But at least when there's dedication like that, you see companies. I mean, there's commerce.
Right. Absolutely. We were speaking with somebody, I can't remember the name or the title, but was a activist in the Linden area and wanting to see the Linden area grow. They now have a roadmap to growth in that area, to economic development in that area. And public transit infrastructure is a huge reason why. So having a dedicated bus rapid transit line along there, you'll start to see some true development pop up along there.
Sometimes, though, the development is becomes out of reach for the people who need it the most, particularly as interest grows in living in the city center in Columbus. There's more competition for those places to live.
Give me a little more example. Where
well,
you're
just
about.
When you if you build it, they will come. Mm-hmm. They'll build the apartment complexes and that kind of a thing. But the closer, you know, the rapid transit, or not the rapid transit in this case, but the public transit in Columbus becomes a selling point, and it becomes a point of competition.
It does. There's research.
Kind of a good news, bad news sort of thing.
There's research out there that the closer you are to public transit, your property values increase.
Exactly.
So I think that these developers, as they look to develop new apartment complex, condo projects, whatever you have, they're looking at public transit, understanding that that is, again, a great equalizer. Moving people in a community that is rapidly growing, mm-hmm. both in jobs and number of people, mobility is key.
What if you learn? I mean, we were talking earlier about getting out front and being part of at the table when developments are being planned, when it comes to CODA's role in all of this. How do you get input from the communities you serve? How do you really learn to understand what they need?
Well, public input is a big part of any future development,
right.
For CODA. We have our public information officer, public affairs administrator, who both go out in the public and take that sentiment back and report to, when the public reports to us what the needs are, we implement those into our plans. So it's a huge part. So we encourage anybody out there that uses our system, doesn't use our system, is looking into CODA's system, to please let us know where we can do better. We talk a little bit about public transit, and one of the challenges we face is we can't be point A, walk out your front door and get you to point B to your doorstep.
You're going
to
have to walk.
There could be some walk, but the beautiful thing is what's happening in the mobility arena is all the different modes of transport that are rapidly increasing. And CODA's commitment is to partner with those organizations, Bird, Lime, which are putting infrastructure.
The bikes and the scooters.
And the scooters, exactly right. And the city did a great thing in requiring them to put those resources in low-income neighborhoods. And so we want to complement that ensuring those different modes of transport are located at our Northland Transit Center, Northern Lights Transit Center, the Linden Transit Center. So these multiple modes make seamless transportation in the community much more easy to access.
For people who really depend on public transportation, it's hard for me to see them sometimes standing outside, particularly in the dead of winter, with absolutely no protection. How do you prioritize where you're going to put those fancy bus stops?
Right. So, well, and there's
some
one thing.
Some of them are pretty stinking fancy.
I'll say one of the biggest challenges in the world of public transit is the weather, right?
Yeah.
And especially here in Central Ohio, yeah. which changes regularly. It affects our routes. It affects our services. Sometimes there's service delays due to snow, rain, thunderstorms, traffic, a lot of things beyond our control. The prioritization usually comes to use. And again, there's a lot of public input of saying, hey, we've got a heavily used shelter that could use some sort of upgrade. But these are all capital projects. And I'll tell you another area that lacks in public transit is just general funding, right? CODA is very lucky to have a great stream of revenue from Franklin County residents. But when it comes to public transit funding from the state, it's basically zero compared to right. the contiguous state. So I think, as you and I discuss, and you are hitting on this great issue today about mobility and low-income neighborhoods and the need for people to have access to jobs and healthcare and education. The mobility, again, being the great equalizer, the state needs to realize that more and invest some of these federal dollars that are put towards roads and bridges and say, we can stop building roads and bridges if we invest in public transit and really give people that need the upward mobility that you've talked about earlier and access to these jobs. The state needs to start realizing that and invest more.
You know, the CEO of CODA said in an interview I read about that when they was asked about high-speed rail or light rail, that the voters have voted on that. They've rejected it, blah, blah, blah. That was a few years ago. I mean, things change, as anyone who's in the gambling industry will tell you, as anyone who's in the medical marijuana industry will tell you, things change. What are the expectations that sometime in the future that might be revisited as a possibility?
Well, just like in any industry, you don't want to say never,
right?
I think there will always be public sentiment towards rail. There's this idea that Columbus is growing and we're the largest market that doesn't have rail. When are we going to fix that?
And if you wait too long, can we afford to fix it when
right.
we'll need it?
Well, it's an expensive investment, yeah. no matter what, whether we do it now or wait. Again, I think one of the greatest solutions to this is the success we've seen on the bus rapid transit line in that CMAX corridor up Cleveland Avenue. We're already looking at possibly working on the federal level to have a similar bus rapid transit run along Broad Street, again, to increase frequency and get people faster where they need to go. Bus rapid transit is comparable in time of arrival when it comes to rail or streetcar, what have you, and it's a much cheaper investment. So I think it's better use of taxpayer funds for us right now to invest how we can put more BRT into our system.
And then what about the streetcar idea? Again, that fixed line that mm-hmm. is so valuable.
Yeah. So that's a political agenda that goes on right. both sides of the spectrum. And you have some that were in a prior administration that saw a lot of value in a streetcar system that another administration would take over and see funding for that not as valuable. But what we have seen is the C-Bus downtown, and what a phenomenal asset to the
that's
community.
That's been extended,
that has been.
Right?
Not extended so much. It still goes from...
I mean, it's been... retained.
It's been retained.
Yeah.
And it's a free service. It goes from the Brewery District all the way up through the Short North. It's extremely – it's if you jump on it, it's packed almost every day.
Yeah.
I take it often to meetings.
I'm out here at the Fawcett Center. But yeah.
We don't come out that far. But when you come downtown, Ann, we'll make sure you get on there.
Right.
But you can see how much the community has embraced C-Bus and how valuable it is to people that live and work downtown, but also residents who come into our beautiful city.
How long can you afford to keep doing that?
Well, and it was – partially subsidized at the beginning.
Right.
Now that we've seen it being such an integral part of community, it is part of our regular operations. So it is part of the benefit of the income tax that comes from Franklin County residents. So it really is a way that Franklin County residents can see their tax dollars at work by seeing a circulator that's free for the community to embrace.
I'm wondering, what are people willing to pay? What does it cost to ride the bus these days?
Let's see, $2.50 for one way, $4 for a two-way pass or a day pass, what have you. So it's still extremely economical when you look at other modes of transportation. And I mentioned earlier that we're looking to partnership with the new modes that are coming to mm-hmm. market. You've got share, on-demand car service. You've got these bikes. You've got scooters. What we're looking at, and you mentioned the new CEO who came on to Coda in April. Her and the organization's commitment is to ensure that Coda is the premier mobility services provider for the region and partners with these organizations so we can have seamless, integrated mobility throughout the community.
We're just about out of time, but I wanted to ask you about the on-demand transportation to improve medical access. Mm-hmm. One of the things it looks at is a web-based platform. And I'm wondering, particularly for low-income people who may not have, you know, a computer, that may not have the kind of web access they need, and then take it to the issue of the Lime bikes or the scooters and that kind of a thing. You need to have a credit card. You mm-hmm. need to have that kind of stream of that a lot of people with limited income don't have.
It's true. The innovation sometimes isn't keeping up with actually the needs of
the
people
reality,
who use
yeah.
the system. So that's something that we constantly have to keep in mind of our core ridership. How are they paying? They're still going to need the fare box. They're still going to need the card swipe access. So while the innovation and technology is available, it's not something that's available to everybody. However, if you look long term, I think that's something that maybe catches up and equalizes somewhere along the way. And you mentioned this, the need for on-demand, and it's really exciting of what we're looking into next year at Coda is a flexible on-demand microtransit option that will get people from the job centers to maybe where our fixed route service doesn't completely touch. So
uh-huh.
this new hospital going down in Grove City, you've got our service that ends maybe about a mile away from the hospital, and people can then call an on-demand Coda car driven by our operators and get them to where we need. So again, first mile, last mile is going to be a big part of these low-income neighborhoods and how to serve them.
Patrick Harris, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Enjoyed it. Anytime, Ann. Thank you so much.
Patrick Harris, Director of Government Affairs and Special Projects for COTA. That's it. Thanks for your time. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.